Welcome to Microwave Journal's Frequency Matters podcast. I'm Pat Hindle. I'm here with my co-host, Gary LaRude. In this three-part series, we'll be talking to Chris Markey and Doug Jorgensen of Markey Microwave about how the company evolved over the years from a hybrid mixer company into a cutting-edge MMIC technology company. Welcome, Chris and Doug.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Great. So can you tell us how you got started and kind of where you stand today?
Oh, man. Yeah. How much time you got?
The short version.
I guess yeah, three. We have three podcasts worth.
Yeah.
So Markey founded in 1991 by my parents, Christine and Ference. My dad had been an expert mixer designer for 20 years prior to that. So he started around 1970-ish timeframe. He started at WJ and then went to Avantech and then Western Microwave. And then in 91, during the fall of the Soviet Union and all that stuff and the peace dividend, he founded Markey Microwave. So the goal was to become the number one hybrid mixer company in the world and put myself and my sister through college. And after like about 15 years, he kind of achieved all of those goals. And the rest was kind of history. I eventually joined the company in 2007. And since then, we've been expanding the products and capabilities essentially exponentially. So now we're talking to you.
And so how did you kind of transform from a hybrid mixer company into a MMIC company?
Slowly and deliberately, I guess is the easiest way to put it. We had always been aware of the IC threat. And so when Hittite came to prominence, when was that? Maybe the 90s. And they were developing virtually every building block you could put onto gallium arsenide that they could to very high frequency. My dad was able to remain somewhat insulated from the threat because he was able to make some really, really good mixers that they couldn't do on gallium arsenide. The whole time I was always worried since I was in grad school in the mid 2000s, I was very aware that my dad had a real threat that could end Markey Microwave as we knew it. I don't think my dad was quite as paranoid as I was, but we always knew that ICs, if done properly, could harm the company fatally. And so we decided around 2010 to get serious about investing in modern IC technology to take us to the next step.
So can I interject a story? So yeah. Probably mid 80s, TI, where I was getting very serious about doing MMIC development. And of course, all that work started with amplifiers. And in the 90s, because of some of the electronic warfare programs that TI's defense business had, TI was trying to take the idea of the planar MMIC structure and apply it to mixers. And I think in the 90s, by that time, Markey was well known as the best mixer supplier. And so a lot of our system programs at TI were buying products from you. And the MMIC development group was basically trying to figure out how could you do it in a MMIC format. And at least over the years that I was there, up until I'd say 97 or 98 when I left, they never could figure out how to crack the code to take a double-balanced three-dimensional mixer and do it in 2D.
The guys at TI couldn't do that?
Correct.
Oh, man, that makes me feel really good.
Well, this is something that I think we kind of take for granted. But if you look at all of the hybrid companies out there, there are lots of hybrid companies, big hybrid companies. And as far as I know, none of them really got into MMICs. Like, it's a great question. Like, why was it Hittite that became this giant MMIC company and not Avantech or Watkins Johnson or, you know, the legacies of these hybrid companies? They could all have
pieces of them did. I think wasn't Sorenza part of Avantech? The only point I'm trying to make, Doug, is that there were companies in like the 80s and 90s who some of those engineers did spin off, but I think you're definitely right that it's very rare to see a hybrid company get into ICs.
Yeah. And I think that the reason is that the worldview is very different. And I think that's why we managed to make the change, is that when you came here, you came from grad school where what you do is simulate everything.
Yeah, I was indoctrinated with the idea. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, like the only RF class I took in grad school was on CMOS. And I was like, this is insane. Like the only way to do RF is CMOS. Like I grew up watching my dad not do CMOS. And every professor I knew was telling me how dumb my dad's business model was.
Yeah. Yeah. In the professor world, the only thing that you can do is integrate everything and scale it to tens of millions of units.
Well, if you want DoD money, right?
Right.
It's got to be the next 10 years off and 1,000x performance improvement.
Yeah. But I think that the difference between the way that you saw things when you came in from grad school, expecting that you were going to simulate everything, that I remember when you first got here, you called me up and you were like, dude, if you simulate in HFSS, if you do a full 3D simulation, it works 100%. And you were astonished because coming from we came from a photonics background, and in photonics you can never, like, you make simulations, but they never really work because it's so hard to simulate on optical scales. Like the fabrication just isn't that good when you're talking about optical scales, and the semiconductor physics are so complicated. But if you simulate a planar structure like a Wilkinson power divider or a coupler, and then you build it, you know, with pretty good fabrication tolerances, it's 100%. If you're careful and you simulate everything about it, then it absolutely works and you can get first pass success. And that's that. So when I showed up, the way that Ferenc would make a new product is he would have 10 prototypes done by the time you got to work.
Like, that's right.
He would get up, drive here from Carmel, and he would be on his 10th prototype when I walked in, and he'd be like, come check this out. This is really cool.
Yep.
And
I came in here, I was like, I'm not doing that. Well, that was just like not for me. I would have rather gone and worked for somebody else.
Yeah. But when I get in, you're on your 10th simulation. And you've already run 10 different designs through HFSS.
But I think that's one thing is the timing. You know, in the 80s or 90s, I'm not sure that HFSS was accurate enough to do that. But I think, Chris, you started at the right time when the simulation tools had matured enough that they could accomplish that. Is that true?
That's a debate that I think Doug and I have. Doug's made the argument, and he might be right, that it would have been very difficult for the people at TI or Hittite or wherever in the 90s to make a mimic-based mixer that was as good as the 3D stuff my dad had done. And I think that's largely just because of the computing power. The mesh size and the parallel processing and all the multiple cores for running multiple parallel frequencies and simulating down to the diode junction from the connector, that's all required if you want to have a first pass win. And so I think, and we've met a lot of mimic designers from, let's say, that came up in the 90s. The ones you meet from that came up in the 90s versus the ones that came up in the last 10 years have a completely different mentality. The ones that came up in the 90s were used to process variation. They were used to having bad models. They were used to spamming 15 different variations on a mask because they weren't quite sure how to impedance match a transistor. Like they had a vague understanding, right? But it wasn't worth necessarily perfecting the model, because if they could get that sweet spot design, they would just turn that into the production mask. And the designers you meet now, especially the ones that are coming up like through grad school now, I think they have a more implicit assumption that the simulations are much closer to what they can fab. And in 3.5s, the foundries have gotten so much better through the years that what used to be considered boutique, I think, in repeatability from wafer to wafer is now considered normal. So I think that's a big difference.
If you look at simulation today, when would you say it works really well and where are the shortfalls?
I should probably let Doug talk. I can speak to mixers. Mixers are very accurate because diodes are very easy to model. They're really just spice models, I think, most of the time. Transistors are much more difficult. I'm not a transistor guy. I'm a diode guy. So all the the diode IC stuff you see coming out of Markey, those are usually my designs. And then the transistor stuff's the other team. But at least in the case of mixers, the real secret is that mixers are not a device technology. They're a circuit technology. So everything outside of the diode is important. But I think in amplifiers, it might be almost the opposite. Do you agree with that? Do you think that's true?
Well, amplifiers are, there's just more going on. There's DC power consumption. There's heating. There's noise.
Linear versus nonlinear.
Yeah, there's you know, the layout of a transistor matters. This is something that I think makes a big difference between us and companies that came in starting with transistor-based products, is that most of our catalog historically has been passive devices like couplers, balans, bias tees, power dividers, filters, diplexers, you know, and those devices, those components that don't have nonlinear devices in them, they simulate beautifully as they simulate within the fabrication tolerances, with the exception of ferrite. Ferrite, you still have to come in and do 10 experiments, you know, in the morning. And we still have that capability. We still got great assemblers. But it's very difficult to simulate them. You can't get material parameters from the manufacturers. It's very difficult to simulate those too accurately. But with transistors, you really have to make a model around the application. So if you're making a low noise amplifier, you have to have a good noise model. If you're making a high power like a power amplifier that has low signal distortion, then you have to understand how the IP3 is going to perform, or the ACPR is going to perform when you have it backed off.
Or the load pull.
Yeah, you have to have a load pull to get, you know, if you're trying to make a class F amplifier, there's so many things that you can do. If you're trying to make a switch with your amplifier, you have to understand, like, there's so many different things that you can do with a transistor. And each application requires some kind of trade-off with the model. So if you just take a model from a PDK that a foundry gives you, and you try to use it for an arbitrary application, it'll work kind of okay. But you won't get the beautiful, like, 60 dB, you know, 30 dB agreement that you can get from a passive device when you use those kind of 3D models.
So if I go back to the 3D mixer, is that something that today you can simulate and get good agreement, or are your passive mixers basically done, cut and dry?
So are you referring to hybrids or mimics?
Hybrids, I guess.
So can you simulate a hybrid mixer? No, not super accurately. And the main reason is that you would need to simulate down to the diode junction. So through the packaging, through the wire bonding, including the epoxy glob top, if it's there. If you could do that, yeah, it would be reasonably accurate, but you are not going to get that information from the diode vendors. They're not going to give you the mask layout, and that does matter. You know, how the diodes are oriented and whether there's a little bit more inductance in the pathway into the diode or not makes a big difference, because that's where the final match is going to be for the you know, RF port.
Well, there's also the fabrication. I argue that the simulation capability is also limited by the repeatability of the devices. So we do studies on the repeatability of different forms of fabrication. So we've done studies on repeatability of hand-wound T3s, repeatability of the ceramics that we buy, and the repeatability of the ICs. And just because I really think it's just volume and you know, tightness of manufacturing, just being careful. The repeatability of the ICs is so much better than any other fabrication technology. So you can only simulate down to the level with which it can be repeated. And so you'd have to test a whole box of mixers to know what the typical performance is, and then back calculate like what the actual fabrication was. And you don't get that for the substrates or for the diodes in a hybrid mixer.
Well, and I would take it one step further. So the question's in some ways preposterous, Gary. And and the reason is simple. Because you cannot make a hybrid mixer the same way twice, at least not perfectly, all of the careful tuning that you're doing in simulation becomes irrelevant.
Right.
The simplest example would be let's say you're trying to optimize L to R isolation, which is kind of the one of the flagship specs of a mixer. If you only need 25 or 30 dB, you can basically eyeball it. If you want 50 dB, it must be simulated and you must tune on the balance structures and you must take into consideration things like diode asymmetry. That can only be done if you have all of the structures modeled down to the final micron and you have repeatability in the fabrication. And since the vector, it's a vectorial cancellation problem. If two vectors cancel to a certain dBc with a certain, phase and amplitude balance. And so since that tolerance in handmade products is probably plus or minus 10 degrees instead of plus or minus 5 degrees, it's basically hopeless. And you might as well just build a bunch of stuff like my dad did. And then of course, the benefit of that is if you build it by hand and it's a bigger structure, you can tune. And that was the name of the game for the hybrid guys through the 70s, 80s, and 90s was, let's build 100 units and we'll hand tune 50 of them. And those are going to be the ones that are premium that we ship to a very hardcore SCD for some military platform.
Well, we really didn't touch on the advantages, as far as cost and volume, of a hybrid versus a mimic. I mean, there still is some demand and reason to do hybrids because you can, if it's a low volume, if you only need 100 pieces, you're probably going to do a hybrid and make more profit margin. Is that the case or what's the trade-off there?
We do almost no new work in hybrids. I can't think.
The MT3. So we don't do any new hybrids where we just have a planar circuit with a diode on it. Because if you can do a planar circuit with a diode, like you said, the scalability, the cost advantages, the repeatability, all the advantages, the supply chain stability for the mimics dominates. The times when we still do hybrids typically involve magnetics. So yeah. Anytime you have to have a low end that goes below 2 gigahertz, say, on some port, that basically means that you have to use some kind of ferrite to pull it down. And that means magnetics. So for example, our MT3 is an IC that has RF and LO balance on it that go from like 1 to 13 gigahertz. And then to get down to the megahertz frequencies on the IF, we still use a hand-wound ferrite core that is wound and assembled on-site in Morgan Hill.
Oh, that's impressive. I didn't know you had completely switched over. It always tends to be a tale of people ordering old products or whatever, so I didn't know.
Well, this is a different problem. This is one of those, this is one of those episodes that we had to delete because it was too offensive. But Pat, the industry forced my hand. You've seen all the industry consolidation and M&A, and right. It wrecked our supply chain. You wouldn't believe how much money I've had to spend just to keep those hybrids afloat for diode supply. So had that not happened, I think we still would be doing a lot more hybrid work and offering things like tuning and stuff like that. But instead, what happened was we started losing suppliers, and this is at multiple levels of the chain, not just the diodes. Other things happened, but the diodes were the biggest problem. So in parallel, once I started seeing the disruption, let's say 4 years ago, we started investing heavily. Like we pretty much tripled our effort on mimics so that we had an insurance plan backup in case we lost all of our supply. And that, I feel like, may have been the most impressive thing we've ever done, because we were able to make 95% of the hybrid mixer line on mimic within about 3 years, starting from almost zero.
It was
a crazy stressful time because customers were designing in these brand new hybrid mixers that we had been releasing, and they were very happy. And these are on major platforms that I won't say, but big ones. And people were livid with us. And I'd say, look, I just can't get the diodes anymore. And they said, well, what are you going to do about it? I said, we're going to design a new mimic for free. And in 12 months, I'm going to give you that chip and you're going to design out the old one. And they actually, usually they were happy, right? Because mimics were going to be lower cost. That was always the carrot, was that I said, and it's going to be cheaper in volume. And so they said, oh, okay. I love a 30% discount or whatever it would be. And then I said, oh yeah. And it's also going to work better and it's going to be repeatable. And they said, yeah, right. You know, like nobody believed us with that. But it turned out to be true. And so virtually every single mixer, with a couple exceptions that I'm working on, everything my dad did since 1971 has been converted over to a Mimic.
Wow. That's a lot. Yeah. And I've heard a lot of other companies complain about that. It's hard to get diodes and old style transistors, you know, that go into hybrid circuits. There's multiple companies there that's kind of dried up, or they're down to their last, you know, source. It's not reliable. It's expensive. Yeah, they've all gotten gobbled up. But doesn't help us either on the advertising side.
Yeah, consolidation has got to be the worst for you guys.
Yeah, it's usually not a good thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's why I think it's kind of you know, you people contact us and are like, want a 15-year supply guarantee for a part. and I understand, you know, for military programs, that's the expectation. And we'll always, you know, we're always trying to support parts as long as we can. We still make parts that were designed in the 90s. If we can get the supplies, sometimes you just have to EOL a part because, you know, if you're trying to push the boundary of technology, you know, sometimes that's something that you have to do. But we always hold our customers' hand to get on to the next thing. You know, we're always replacing our own parts with better, you know, better implementations using new technology. And we don't always support parts forever, but we always get our customers onto the new part with the least
pain don't kill possible. Something if we don't kill something if there's no new solution. If there is a new solution, we have the conversation to see if they're willing. And the way that I think the general expectation of the electronics industry is that everything sold and that goes onto a bomb will have some kind of semiconductor-like business model, meaning it's always in stock, it's cheap in volume, and it's perfectly repeatable every time. And that expectation is actually projected onto hybrid products, which is an insane expectation, right? Because like even just the production yields in a hybrid might be, sometimes you're happy with 95%. You know, you try to push it up as close as you can to 100 as possible, but you're never going to get there because there's human beings touching it.
Right.
Whereas, you know, what do you think how many sigmas do you have to go in like a silicon germanium hardcore process from GlobalFoundries or something? It's probably like 10 to the minus 5.
Yeah, three wafers.
Yeah. It's like you have to order three wafers and you might have a few pieces that are bad. Like,
yeah.
It's orders of magnitude different. And yet, if we sell a bias T today, the quality and repeatability expectation is identical to that PLL from ADI. Yeah. It's like, wow, okay. and since we do both ICs and hybrids, I mean, that's a challenge. Like, that's a business model problem.
Yeah, we get it.
And you guys have kind of noticed that you were always about the mixer a long time ago, but now you've built a portfolio of devices around that in addition. And you've improved the whole LO chain in doing that. Can you talk a little bit about how that's been accomplished?
Yeah, probably the first and best example of that is the balance. When we started, there was really only one balance company, which was Picosecond. It's part of Tektronix now. And for years and years, you know, we were making mixers and selling mixers, and they had multiple balance in them, and it just never... Nobody ever thought to sell the Balan on its own. Why would you want that? And the Balans, since we've released them, have been the fastest growing product line for Marquee. And they're something that, for the most part, it has to be hand-built. Most of our Balans are hand-built. They use ferrite to go the full range. People use them typically for analog to digital converters on the front end. And we have continuous demands. We just started releasing. So we've released some machine built versions. This is a good example of the kind of diversity of technologies that we have at our disposable
manufacturing capabilities.
Yeah. So since we're not tied, we're a step ahead of, I think, fabless IC companies, because they aren't tied to a foundry, but they are tied to integrated circuits. We're not tied to integrated circuits. We have, if it's best to make a Balan using a hand assembly technique, then we do it that way. If it's best to do it in softboard, like a Rogers laminate or ceramic we do it that way. If it's best to do it in ICs because of the repeatability and the fabrication tolerances, then we do it that way. And if you look at our catalog, we've got ballons that are made using all those different techniques. We make modules, you know, big, high cost modules that are hand tuned individually. We make surface mount units that are somewhat mass produced as much as you can mass produce
tested
something.
Tested with robots and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Tested with robots. And we make IC versions. And for each problem like that, we start off agnostically. We just say, what does the customer need and what's the best way to get it done? And the process always pretty much starts with a circuit simulation in Microwave Office or in ADS. And then we get an estimate of what the best technology to use is, move it into a 3D simulation. And then we can make a lot of different solutions that are inaccessible, I think, to other companies. So we've used that basic technique to expand into passive devices, which are ballons, power dividers, couplers, quad hybrids, which are, you know, fancy versions of couplers. We can use packaging. So by going into couplers, that means that we know how to do triplate strip line construction, which is the best type of construction available in the you know, it's closest to 50 ohm outside of a coaxial. And that allows us to make a lot of different products that are otherwise inaccessible. There's some products that you have to make. Anything that you want the very best performance tends to still require a large construction. You're usually making some kind of trade-off to get to a planar construction. So to get into a MMIC, you have to trade something.
Getting into and out of a chip is a lot harder than people make it seem, I think.
There's the transitions, the packaging transitions.
You know, I would say this is a huge advantage of the company because we came out of the hybrid mentality. For us, the product was everything and the chip was a piece of it. I think there are a lot of companies whose mentality is the chip is everything and somebody else is going to figure out how to get into and out of it.
Out of packaging.
Or at least, yeah. or they're like, well, eventually we'll hire a packaging expert to help us. Like,
yeah.
And for us, I seriously consider once you get the chip back, I think you're only 10% done.
Yeah.
I think 90% of the rest of the way is where you make your money. It's where you optimize. It's where you make your profit margin. It's where you learn about problems that the customer is going to experience. And that's actually a huge problem. If you have to figure out how to package your own die, you understand the problems that the key customer is going to deal with. And so what you do is you figure out how to help them avoid that through various means. Either you improve your packaging or you write tutorials for them or, you know, whatever it's going to be. But at these frequencies that we're dealing with, and I'm pretty much always assume we're above 10 gigahertz, not that many people are particularly good at that. You start to whittle away your options once you get above 6 gigahertz in terms of engineering expertise. So yeah, because we're like a full stack manufacturer, meaning like hybrids and ICs and all that, I think that gives us a really good insight. And that's essentially how we've come to think about product development, which is we have these insights. And so let's see if there's other building blocks that we know we could do well. And so to get back to your question, Pat, that's why we're doing LO chains, is that we've learned a lot through the years about what makes it hard to make a good LO chain. And that's the amplifier, multiplier, filter, all that stuff. And so we're making these complementary chipsets that allow the customer to have very easy access to a great performing converter.
Yeah, you talked about that when I was out to visit you recently, and I know you mentioned that you optimize your amplifiers, you know, for the LO chain that you're making, whereas everybody else might have to buy an off-the-shelf amplifier that's not optimized for the right parameters. Can you talk about, you know, what you do in that area?
Yeah, that's something when I was talking about the trade-offs that you make when you're doing a transistor model. That's one of the fundamental things is that, so our amplifiers are specifically designed explicitly to drive our mixers. And so we know we're the experts in the world on the problems of driving a mixer. Every time we get a tech support question about a mixer, the first question is, how are you driving the LO? How are you turning it on? What's the power source?
I mean, so...
And that's usually where it is?
Well, for years, when I started here, like 12 years ago, my dad was minting money for Hittite and Syntellis.
Yeah.
Because every T3 he sold, he was recommending these part numbers. And I kept saying, Dad, can't we make these ourselves? Like every unit you're selling goes with a $100 die.
Yeah.
What are you doing? And he's like, I don't want to do amps.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't.
And Doug and I just saw like, and we would see the block diagrams. You know, customers would be like, oh, you know, we need help because of XYZ. And they'd show us the block diagrams. And we'd always say, well, what amp are you using? And oh my God, just I knew how much we were making or how many units we were selling.
Yeah.
Mm. And then I started calculating the profits that Hittite was seeing compared to what we were seeing, because our mixer was way lower profit margin. It was hand built,
right?
Compared to like, you know, just running a production wafer.
Well, especially when we're doing all the tech support
for all the tech support because we're
and the applications.
Yeah. So they're like, how do we optimize the mixer? And I said, well, you have to optimize the amp. Well, how do we optimize the amp? Okay, here's how you.
Yeah.
Like, go call up Hittite, man.
Yeah.
And Hittite would give you a referral fee.
No, you know, many, many years ago, this is probably like 2009, so a couple years in, I sat down with some Hittite salespeople, and I desperately tried to get them to design in our surface mount bias T as a reference design, because every one of their distributed amplifiers they would sell on their data sheet with a schematic diagram showing, you know, an off chip conical inductor and a blocking cap. And I was like, guys, we sell these right now. Make it easier for your customer. Like we'll specifically recommend this die for the T3 mixer, but you can also recommend the bias T. And they never did it. It's always upset me.
It only worked one way, huh?
You know, what a bunch of failures. Like,
yeah, losers.
But yeah, if they'd only listened to me, they would have succeeded.
Yeah, what's funny is that every amp that we recommended back then, well, every company at least is gone. Centelex amps, Hittite amps. There could have been other companies we were recommended that got bought and sold many times since then.
Yeah.
So at a minimum, we're providing a secure supply chain for our complete converter solution.
Yeah. Yeah. Vertically integrate. That's what we're trying to do. Yeah.
So to get back to the question, for LO amps, what's important? You want consistent power level. You want to drive the amplifier close to saturation so that if you have variation in your synthesizer, or your LO, you know, supply power, it doesn't affect your mixer. So we tend to design amps with higher gain than a typical multipurpose amp would be. You want a good amount of output power. You want the bandwidth to match, you know, something close to our mixer for our purposes. We want the saturated output power to be either the high teens or the low 20s.
And you want it to match to the mixer. I think that's an important thing because of efficiency. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you don't want to use, for example, a 1 watt amp, right? You don't want to have a 30 dBm amp driving into an H diode mixer because you're going to be wasting 90% of your power. And a lot of times people will put a pad in between the LO and the mixer. And sometimes there are still some rare circumstances where I recommend a pad, you know, a small pad, a small attenuator. But part of my quest is to eliminate that attenuator. It drives me crazy that you would spend all this power and money on an amp that drives hard so that you can go into a mixer and then put an attenuator in between them. So I'm trying to eliminate that. And that's why we, with all of our amplifiers, we test them with all of our mixers or with a wide collection of mixers so that a customer doesn't have to guess about what kind of performance they're going to get.
Yeah, that's not good. You're buying more amplifier than you need, and then you're adding an attenuator, and you're just creating heat.
Then getting a heat sink, and then your mechanical guys are complaining, and then you've got a swap problem, and then, yeah, for especially like an airborne application, it's a whole thing.
Or battery-operated one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've got multiple channels. So the power is very, very important. That's the first thing we look at, especially at higher frequencies. Most amplifiers... Most of the processes people typically use die out around 45 gigahertz. And so we use a process that gives us high power up to 55 gigahertz or above, you know, into millimeter wave. So we don't have to, we don't really worry about the frequency bands. So typically people focus on certain frequency bands that are used for different applications. But for LOs, the LO could be all over the place. Maybe you're doing a high side conversion or a low side conversion.
It's not. It's usually not in the band.
Or
right?
A synthesizer. Yeah, you specifically don't want your LO to be in band because you've got an isolation problem. Having a broad band enables more flexibility in your frequency plan selection. So that's part of the goal. And then the most recent thing we released is low phase noise amplifiers. And, you know, we're a little late to the party. We're the fourth company, I think, to release low phase noise amplifiers.
But we can promise we've wanted to do this for 5 years. So we may have been early in the idea phase, but it took us a long time.
Well, I think that we've spent more time and effort on understanding phase noise than any other component company, certainly. I think most people use an HPT process, throw a graph on the data sheet and say, we got a low phase noise amp.
Yeah. One test.
We're using the best circuit design methodology, and we're doing very, very careful investigation, partially because we want to use these things to drive our nonlinear transmission lines. The nonlinear transmission lines are what we think is going to be the best solution for LO chains for the next 20 years. They're super low phase noise. They can be pretty efficient. And the knock on them in the past has been that they're difficult to use. So we're designing the amplifier, the filters, the biasing sequence, you know, all the application support that you need to use the nonlinear transmission line without all of the pain that it may have come with in the past.
So how do you guys define your company now? You know, what type of platform and how do you compare to other companies?
I would say we're kind of like, I like the term full stack. I feel like that's appropriate. We're a full stack microwave manufacturer. So we can do of components. I should be very specific. We are a high performance component company that manufactures with all the various technologies that are considered modern and up to date. So semiconductor, hybrid. We want to build component. We want to enter product categories that we feel like we can be the number one in the performance metric. So we always avoid, I mean, the simplest way to be a product development person at Marky is come up with an idea and then go find out if Mini Circuits does it. And if Mini Circuits does it, we don't do it because they're always going to wreck our margin. They have a company built on a mentality of cutting cost, which is a great business model. I mean, like Walmart exists for this reason, and Mini Circuits exists for this reason, and Amazon exists for this reason. So if you can, you know, get cost out of the transaction, get cost out of the bill of materials, just optimize everything towards that particular axis of optimization, you have a really strong business case. And that they've done that, and it's a really effective, and they're really big because of it. We have done almost the opposite. So we always focus on performance first, and we ask what is the best way to make, you know, this particular solution. And then we work our way backwards and ask ourselves questions like, well, okay, does Mini Circuits do it? Okay, if no, then, you know, continue.
Can we do better?
Can we
how much better can we do?
Or we say, do they do it? Okay, yes, but it's not as good as maybe we actually will say to the customer, can you buy this from Mini Circuits?
Yeah, we'll send them the data sheet.
And they'll say,
you can use this.
Sometimes they say, oh, I didn't know they had that. Thanks. And then they go buy that.
There goes your royalties again.
Well, you know, I feel like Ted should call me and give me some money because I'm definitely a good app support guy for them. But typically what will happen is the customers will say, because they're talking to us, so they kind of already know our brand, I guess. And they'll say, no, I know that part. It's not quite what I need. And we'll say, okay, what do you need? And they'll say, I needed a 10 dB more this and 4 dB more that and, you know, X, Y, Z. And then we sit down and we think, yeah, I like that idea. And so we proceed. So we're definitely a performance solutions company for single function or limited function blocks in the, you know, megahertz through millimeter wave space. That's who Marky is.
Yeah.
And how would you, if you take that to a deeper level in terms of you want to deliver better performance, where are the boundaries in terms of how you do that, in terms of what you want to manufacture inside versus access outside? Is the differentiation coming through design, or is it some trick in manufacturing?
It's all of those. It could be any of those.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, so internally, we're always trying to improve our capabilities. We're buying manufacturing equipment. We're especially automated manufacturing equipment like the pick and place, the die bonder, the
laser soldering.
Yeah, the laser soldering. We're the only company in the world, I think, certainly the only company in the industry with the laser soldering capability so that we can do
for gold tin soldering
high volume quasi hand-assembled products.
We'll make a bigger splash this later. I think we'll make a pretty sweet video, but it's amazing to watch a pulse laser melt solder. It's very satisfying. It suits my love of video games.
Yeah. It's lasers. Like, it's the future. Like, how could you not love it?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
But we're always doing that. We're trying to make like very close relationships with certain vendors. There are certain vendors out there that are our best friends that can do things that nobody else can do, and we've got them all on speed dial. And so it's, you know, there's always a question of like whether we do it in-house or whether we can find a way to send it out. Usually if we can find an expert to send it out to, that's something that we'll do.
Well, and a big difference between Marky of old and Marky of new is that we don't really get ourselves involved with any product that's not scalable, with a few exceptions. So there has to be a path towards volume potential. And the reason that, not from the market side, but from our manufacturing side. Yeah. So the reason is that the first 5 years I was at Marky, I spent a lot of time just trying to figure out how to help my dad with certain custom mixers that he had sold. And it's daunting work to be doing all these customs, and you sell five a year and you can never remember quite how you did it the last time. And then it finds out that the wafer that you used is now depleted and you can't find the wafer. Oh, it's not fun. There's actually a lot less money in it than you would think, because you're spending so much time on it.
Well, the biggest reason not to do it is because while you're doing that, you just can't focus on what's new.
And it's opportunity cost.
Like,
and
you can't see what, you can't be reading papers. You can't be talking to new vendors. You can't be getting new equipment online. Yeah. That's the kind of stuff we really like.
And try to recruit a undergrad coming out of school and say, guess what you're going to do? You're going to read SCDs all day and debug a 1994 mixer. Yeah. Like, nobody's going to take that job.
Doesn't mean
people take the job, but the hot shot you're looking for isn't going to take that job. He's going to go work, or she's going to go work at Facebook or Google whoever else is down the street from us.
Yeah.
So as you look at your business model, are there particular markets that interest you in the world today?
Boy, that's a huge question. So most of our customers are electronic warfare and test and measurement. And they're the ones that are always trying to push the boundaries. They're the ones that we know really well. I would say there's a lot of markets that
we're on their speed dial.
Yeah, we're the close vendor that they want to know, because there have been years where our R&D has been completely captive to large test and measurement and EW companies, just their requests, just not even doing anything that we think is particularly interesting on our own, just stuff that they say, this is what we need right now. But there are other markets that, as we grow to be more scalable, it's interesting to say, where can we take our technology? Like, what other applications could we potentially get into by using the same techniques that we've used to make the best performance components? You know, if we're already using a scalable technology, is it possible that we could make something that could be on, you know, a higher volume commercial product, or
I'll give you a good example of a market product. Military radio.
Military radio.
So military radio is one of those. It's like intermediate volume, but definitely cost sensitive, but also performance sensitive. And I would say historically, I'm guessing we've done almost zero. And that's an area where we could penetrate if we probably need to learn a bit more and expand the sales channel a little bit into those areas. But from a purely pragmatic point of view, definitely it's something we could try to go after. But again, one of the things that people used to mock my dad over was that he was too expensive. You know, Marky was always the most expensive mixer, even though it might work. And our ASPs, our average sale price for our products has really gone down every year since I've been here, probably. But that's because of the semiconductor pivot. So by having access to semiconductor technologies, we can get to the scale and the volume that would be required to compete with that kind of, you know, military radio slot.
And it opens up new worlds.
Exactly. And so I don't know what our total addressable market would be, but I know that from an innovation point of view, we start with the EW and the test and measurement people. And And if adjacent markets are interested, we are very excited to look at their problems too.
Well, it sounds like you are opportunity rich.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
plenty of work.
Yeah. We're always hiring new people. So, if you're tired of your current company,
and you guys are in a tough market there.
Oh my God. You have no idea. It's brutal. Yeah. But we've gotten more aggressive with it. I have a couple strong opinions that I won't share about what I think the future of recruiting engineers is going to look like, but it's maybe the biggest problem, and this is just a RF problem, that I would love it if, I think you guys should do a whole article survey thing about this, but I think that students and schools are increasingly less interested in E&M. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably what's going to happen is the companies like, you know, Marky and whoever are going to have to hoof a lot of that education. And we have a podcast coming out where it's just me giving a talk at Stanford over the summer to a bunch of undergrads. And I think I asked at one point, how many of you have taken RF? And I think none of them raised their hand. And then I think I asked something like, how many of you, and at the end of the talk, how many of you are interested in going into RF? And I think one of them raised his hand and he came up to me at the end and he goes, well, I'm going to work at Keysight next year. So,
so I had to be.
Yeah. But he was, I think I asked him what he was doing. I think he was going to do like FPGA stuff.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's not RF.
Yeah. DSP.
But hey, you know what? He's at Stanford. He could probably do whatever he wants.
Hey, good for us.
You should probably use the term wireless instead of RF.
Is that sexier?
Yeah.
Or,
maybe. Yeah. I think it has a little more cachet. Yeah.
So you guys do have your own podcast series that's available?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you like hearing us jabber. There's several more hours.
Yeah, this one's been very, this whole podcast has been very serious, I think. I think our...
Yours is a little lighter.
Yeah, ours is a little more goofy,
yeah.
Intentionally. Well, so the basic idea, we originally wanted to call it Beers with Engineers because we think we're funny when we're drinking beer, like at the end of the, like, you know, you're at IMS and you go over to National Instruments because they're having beer and wine. And so you go and you get your beer and you hang out at the booth and you're just chatting away with engineers, not talking about work and
right.
usually having a good time, you know, talking about random things. And so at one point, Doug and I were like, we should just record these conversations.
It'd be fun.
And we were going to call it Beers with Engineers and we were going to actually be drinking beer the whole time talking. And we don't do that.
Well, we recorded a few and they were,
I actually have this,
let's do one
as, you know, figurehead and CEO. I'm always worried about HR problems, but
yeah,
I don't know if I should be drinking beer on a podcast. I could tell you this much. We recorded an episode last year in Boston, like in one of the hotel conference room or in one of the hotel lobbies. And we were talking to a friend of ours, interviewing him, and a fairly prominent technology guy in the industry hijacked the podcast, was hammered drunk, saying things he really shouldn't have been saying about people at the show. And it was like, oh my God.
Yeah, that one's
like,
in the vault.
So the whole like mixing beers with engineers may be a bad idea after all.
There's a danger in that.
Well, yeah. We kept telling him, we're like, this is recording. You were like all of a sudden we were the Howard Stern show. You know?
Well, Chris and Doug, thank you for spending some time with us, giving us kind of an overview of the evolution of Marky. It's been very interesting and obviously not just a mixer company anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been fun. Spread the word.
Will do.
All right. Thanks, guys.